Want to welcome you all to Tuesday evenings at the Modern. I'm Terry Thornton. I'm curator of education. I really appreciate you coming out tonight. It's great to be back after being off for a week. It has been a really great run, this Tuesday evening series, and there is more to come. Next week, we have the inexhaustible poet, originator of Ubu Web and much more, including editor of I'll Be Your Mirror, the selected Andy Warhol interviews. That being Kenneth Goldsmith, and he will be here to present his presentation, The Hyperlinked Warhol, The Artist as King of Media. Also, in conjunction with this special exhibition, Andy Warhol, The Last Decade, we continue our ongoing artist-led tours this Sunday with artist Thomas Fulmer. I think all of you are familiar with the series. There is an artist every Sunday at 1 o'clock, top of the stairs, to take you through the Andy Warhol exhibition. These have been a huge hit, and because I've had so many inquiries by both those who attended and those who missed Noah Simblis this past Sunday about if there was a chance to revisit or to hear his presentation, I'll go ahead and let you in on the fact that we're planning to put those podcasts up on the website. I am to blame for the delay, but I promise to get right on it, so I encourage you to be on the lookout for those as well. Another announcement before I introduce our esteemed guest. We have, you probably noticed when you were coming in, we have our friends from Art Lies magazine here tonight to promote both the magazine, for any of you who are not familiar with it, and to also promote a program that we're going to do with them. And I'm going to read exactly what Aaron has written for me about this program so I don't make any mistakes. It is a partnership between The Modern and Art Lies. Art Lies at The Modern will be the name of the program. It is a quarterly reading group for interested members of the public. Held at the museum, each meeting's discussion will focus on a feature essay from the current issue of Art Lies, as well as related supplemental readings. Art Lies at The Modern will take place roughly 2 weeks following the dispersal of each new issue, meeting at The Modern for an hour-long discussion of the text at hand. Aaron White and Allison Hurst are heading this up, working together on it, and Aaron says this is a great opportunity to engage in local and statewide art community while keeping your intellectual gears moving. If interested, please make sure to leave your email address at the table at the auditorium entrance. In return, you will receive more information regarding date, time, and inaugural meeting. And if for some reason you don't get a chance to do that tonight, I'll have that set up next week as well. So can do it then. Okay, let's see. All right. Okay, so that brings us to tonight's lecture, which I know is being met with a great deal of anticipation, and I want to get to it as much as you do. So I'm going to, unfortunately, give you a very brief introduction of both Rhea and Rebecca in hopes that you will do some of your own investigating. The subject of tonight's presentation is Orchard, which is a three-year gallery project housed in a storefront at 47 Orchard Street on New York's Lower East Side that was founded as a limited liability corporation in April 2005 by a collective of artists, writers, film, and video makers, including tonight's guest, art historian and writer Rhea Anastas, and artist Rebecca Quaitman, who shows as R.H. Quaitman. Rebecca is a painter who lives and works in New York, where she is currently on the faculty of the Milton Avery Graduate School of Arts at Bard College, where she also received a B.A. in 1983. She received the Rome Prize Fellowship in 1992 and attended the postgraduate program in painting at the National College of Art and Design in Dublin, Ireland in 2001. Rebecca was a founding member and the director of Orchard from 2005 to 2008. She currently has an exhibition at the ICA in Boston, where her work is also in this year's Whitney biennial, and she is preparing for a survey exhibition at the Neuberger Museum, SUNY, and a project exhibition for SF MoMA this coming fall. So I'm really stunned that she has time to be here, to tell you the truth. To learn more about Rebecca's... that made you tired, didn't it?
Yes.
To learn more about Rebecca's own work, I invite you all to her lecture tomorrow night at 6:30 at the Meadows Museum at SMU. I hope you'll make it out for that. I think we're keeping her hopping. She goes from there then to the Blanton in Austin, so it's nonstop. And Rebecca is sitting to your right, and then Rhea, of course, is sitting to your left. And Rhea is an art historian and critic, now teaching critical studies. Is that correct, Rhea? At the University of Southern California. Along with Rebecca, Rhea is one of the founding members of Orchard, where she curated exhibitions, wrote about work, and played a critical role in the business end of the operation. That's a little fact I picked up on when they were talking about this earlier. I don't know if I was supposed to tell that. Among other writing and editing projects, because like Rebecca, Rhea is very, very busy, Rhea co-edited Dan Graham Works, 1965 to 2000, which came out in 2001. And more recently, she has contributed to the publication of the critically acclaimed retrospective Dan Graham Beyond at MoCA in L.A. Recent articles include The Artist is a Currency with Greg Bordovitz, Andrea Frazier, Yuta Kother, and Glenn Ligon, Gray Room 24, which was from the summer of 2006, and Rendezvous Under the Counter on Dave Yoselet and Garth James at Elizabeth D. Gallery in New York. She's also written continuously for Text zur Kunst. She wrote for Text zur Kunst, I'm sorry, number 65, also number 67, and she's written for the most recent issue, which coincidentally also has an essay about R.H. Quaitman in it. So I don't know about you, but I'm going to try to get my hands on one of those. And Rhea is currently working on a book about Andrea Frazier's Untitled 2003. Some of you may remember Andrea Frazier being here for this lecture series, and Andrea was also a part of Orchard, which I think is something they will mention tonight. Okay, based on interviews and writing, Orchard, it seems... seems to have been a critical marker in a very interesting time where its founders, its participants, and its audiences indulged each other with discussions and considerations of various pertinent and timely issues such as critical discourse, institutional engagement, as well as individual concerns and aspirations. I suspect tonight's presentation will both inspire and ground those of us who believe in endeavors such as Orchard, as we have the opportunity to hear directly from those who were there and who made it happen. So would you please join me in welcoming R.H. Quaitman and Rhea Anastas.
Thank you, Terry. That was such a nice introduction. Thanks for coming tonight. Looks like a nice group. So this is going to be a presentation in three parts. We do everything in parts at Orchard. There's two of us speaking for the 12. I mean, if we had more people, you'd have more points of view. But since it was a multiple project, at least you have two points of view here. So I brought some slides. And I'll start. Then there's a video that Andrea Frazier made with another partner, filmmaker Jeff Price, that we will screen for 15 minutes. And then Rebecca brought slides and she'll speak. I mean, we want to be really informal, and actually we might lapse into sort of the way that we were in the gallery, because when it came to the gallery, we would be in the space, or one of us, and that was a large part of the project, was having someone who organized the show and knew the work there to talk and to kind of do art discourse by hand and one by one, person by person. So anyway, but we're kind of in lecturing mode, and then we may interject into each other.
I'll say that
this group would not have fit in Orchard. That's how small it was.
Absolutely.
So it seems like a good audience to us.
Is the sound good in the back? Okay. So I'm going to focus on some of the art historical questions and start us out on the early part of the chronology. And I very much want to talk about the idea of art history being done by artists and a gallery being done by artists and our criteria for kind of curatorial inclusion and working with works being historically based and artistic criteria as opposed to, you know, other kinds of criteria coming from other places in the art world. And so that's a lot about what I'm emphasizing, and I'll be talking about some of the older works that we showed at the gallery. First, to just think about time, 2004. Remember 2004? Yeah. I mean, it's an impossibility art historically to talk about 2004, but and we can't even think, it's too soon to think of what events, you know, were important. So, but just kind of a few lines, like pencil lines on paper in terms of what was going on and the mood. And it really is, you know, how to describe a cultural and political mood. Two currents or energies kind of organized the moment. We were a year into an American war in Iraq. Now we're 7 years into that war. And financial and commercial activity in one of America's centers, New York, was just really resuming full force after the rupture that was produced by the events of 9/11. I mean, those were felt all over the country, resonated globally, but New York really took a very specific, had a very specific trauma there. So these two things were connected, this economic upturn and the war climate. Within art, you know, the map of art had changed since the late 90s. Art was becoming decentered, and art is now global. It was a time of great expansionism, and, you know, increasingly it was an unprecedented boom in the art market. We could see it then, and certainly we can see it even better now from the perspective of after, you know, 2008. Artists and activists organized to protest the Republican convention during the summer of 2004, which was held in New York. It was an election year. I kind of just mentioned that to remind you. These voices were sort of, they were important, and there was really a moment of energy in the protests against that war, but they seemed really quiet and pale in relationship to the kind of revolutionary standard that the 60s represented. Hard to compare them. Also, those voices of dissent were really highly managed in this post 9/11 climate of high security. Some have talked about it as an age of protected democracy. Some have talked about it as, you know, a kind of trauma. Our criticism is just starting to think about these issues. So it's November. George Walker Bush was elected for a second term. I think we really started talking strongly about doing something. That event kind of catalyzed our complaints and things that we were feeling about the art world and our own way of reflecting on our own position in the art world. That event somehow created an impetus. Just want to bring two quotes and one from Rebecca that you wrote about 2004. She said, "We wanted to examine for ourselves how late market capitalism was writing art history, who was and was not being shown, and how these exhibitions were constructed, written about, and sold. This was not the time to helplessly retreat into our studios or offices, patiently waiting for the established conduits to dictate our moves." So this atmosphere, it's very hazy and vague to talk about, but a feeling that it was a difficult time, and yet being a little tiny bit empowered by that time, like, what do you have to lose? Let's just try to do something. Another quote I brought to read from actually a really interesting text in Art Forum that year in 2004, instituted in the December issue these year-end wrap-ups, and they would focus on different cities. So that year, John Kelsey wrote about New York. John Kelsey's an artist critic. And he wrote, "This year was halogen lit, smooth as safety glass, and punctuated by ever-peaking terror alerts, no doubt manufactured by the Bush people in anticipation of their show of force at Madison Square Garden." It's referring to the convention. "The year may go down as the most managed in the history of New York, the year that so many potential and imaginary explosions were diffused and diverted, the year that the wartime climate served as a consistent and dependable stabilizing device. The year had a certain managerial logic, a logic that applied to daily life as well as to cultural production, guiding the movement of money, people, and art into and out of New York." And again, that sense of the movement of money really coming back with full force was really crucial. That's a kind of backdrop against, I want you to kind of imagine what you'll see in terms of our project. So it was a very particular time in a very particular place that we're talking about. And I should just say about the art world too, I mean, there's many art worlds, or there are multiple layers within an art world, and so we're talking about a really tiny little corner in a neighborhood. Partly you can see it in the physical space, partly you can, it's about geography. I think we have a map somewhere here. This funny corner of the Lower East Side that is very far south and very far east, kind of in a no man's land in between the East Village and the Lower East Side that people know, and the financial district and the South Street Seaport. So,
right.
Okay, so the election, and we were talking, and I just show the space as we found it on 47 Orchard Street, because I think we could have talked for a very long time without having done something, and then we started to look at real estate, and things become very concrete. You start to look at spaces, and all of a sudden, it's okay, when does the lease start? Here, where's the rent money? And I think that was also another catalyst.
We found it on Craigslist.
Found the space on Craigslist that I showed. And so then once we rented the space in March of 2005, it was okay. That was, I think, important for us because we tend to be a bit too abstract and theoretically minded. So it was, okay, you've got to do something now. You've got this space. You're paying the rent. You can't waste this opportunity. So start thinking about what you're going to show. Here's the email invitation for our opening group show. I mean, it's funny to show an email, but it's really important. We did everything this way. We never printed invitations. We never took out ads. So I think
we barely had a sign on the door. I mean, that was a huge, like, do we even have a sign? Let alone a name. That was also a problem, whether or not what the name.
So something about just the barest bones of what you would need to curate and do projects and then communicate those projects to people. And a lot of why we did the invitation for the first show was that we had a performance going on and we needed to bring, there was a live performance and we needed to get an audience there. So this show I'll talk about for a little bit is important to our working method in terms of our ideas about art history. And it was to represent a recent work of art history, a performance that Andrea Fraser had done in 1991, I'll skip forward. Okay, so here's the 1991 version of that at American Fine Arts Gallery in Soho in New York. And she did that work with Alan McCollum. So you're seeing on the walls Alan's plaster surrogate series that began in 1982. And these are objects with a flat black center, and then they're raised to look like mats and frames. They're not paintings. They're actually cast in plaster as a single object in volume and then painted different color for the center mat and frame. They're kind of blank paintings. He calls them plaster surrogates, models for paintings. They're made in large numbers, yet each one is unique. A lot of things about permutations and scale in his practice. But Fraser asked McCollum to use his work as a kind of object and potentially prop in this performance. And the way it worked, it was done by actors in the 1991 version. And when a gallery viewer would come into the gallery, a monologue of about 15 minutes would start that the actor would deliver. It goes through six positions, and it's about the art as a kind of social experience. and the positions and characters shift. There's no exchange with the audience member. It's a monologue that unfolds. And the positions vary from somebody who is a connoisseur and an in art world insider to somebody who is not familiar with art, even feels excluded by art. So it's different degrees of kind of fluency with art and then distance and even alienation from art. It has a very strong mood. So you'll see Fraser performing that in our space in the video that we'll show. So we asked her and started talking to her. The opening show was in some sense curated by Fraser and Rebecca and myself. And that's just McCollum's work.
Are you going to talk a little bit about Colin DeLand and her, just the fact that there was a lot of the artists at Orchard were showing with this at this gallery called American Fine Arts, and he had died in 03?
He had died in 03, and that's another thing you
can
locate in 04
is that happened.
He had a gallery. He started out in the East Village, and then he had this space in Soho, and then he moved into a space on 22nd Street, and that gallery finally closed in 2004. Fraser had worked with him. That had been the gallery she'd worked with in New York. So
Philip Muller,
some of our
and
group.
Gareth and Moira all worked with him. And so the loss of that gallery was a huge hole for a lot of artists, like how to go on in the art world without that very particular context.
Because
hugely important.
DeLand was an artist, and something that was very unique about the gallery was that it was really a space of argument. He generated and showed and supported a lot of the practices associated with institutional critique, and so it was a very strangely skeptical, critical kind of gallery that actually had been operating in the center of the art world. And so that was something that we, something of that spirit we tried to continue in different times. So we talked to Fraser about restaging the work, and then we created a group show out of that. This is a photograph by Moira Davey, another one of the members. It's untitled from 1999. We worked with this Fraser script and generated some kind of thematics and imagery, and a lot of it had to do with domesticity, childhood, upbringing, how we are educated and socialized into art. So there's a lot of kind of imagery of the home. And so we kind of worked with that imagery in the script to group different works together from the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. I'll jump forward to one really great installation view. So we borrowed some McCollum plaster surrogates, a small set. McCollum gave us the permission to sort of break them up, and we inserted other works in this grouping. And this was a backdrop, now a group show, instead of a single showing of McCollum's surrogates that Fraser performed against. So here in the center with the magazine page images, Martha Rosler, House Beautiful, Bringing the War Home, Giacometti, this is from 67 to 72, her really, really well-known series that started out as cutout collages in which she had Vietnam War imagery that she would basically collage and montage together with Dwelling and Lifestyle and fashion magazines. It was really important for us to sort of, you're also looking at the design of our space here. It's very small, and there are some, you know, works that were really important to us socially and politically from art history, like Martha Rosler and others, and to kind of borrow those works and hang them and actually kind of create a direct viewing experience with them. Thinking about what these works were materially, because at first they were distributed through newsprint flyers and things like that. That was important. And also I think in the sense of the 60s starting to be really historicized in art history, starting to be collected by museums, we wanted to kind of do something different, peel back all the layers of institutional mediation that was sort of giving all this importance and value to this work, and kind of just put it in this really small, domestically scaled space and start also bringing that work into dialogue with the present, kind of holding it up with recent works by younger artists, works that are in our group with, you know, with recent work, and sort of see how it held the test of time and see what kinds of conversations could be generated from it. So those were kind of the hallmarks of our curating, mostly group shows, although some monographic shows and individual shows, that's something we have to talk about. Very much intergenerational, and often a show would start from some historical works, and then we would start to build up meanings and create contexts from that. Just a word about Chelsea. These are photographs that the artist Sylvia Kobalski took in 1997, and the top is a streetscape in Soho, which was the art neighborhood throughout the 70s and 80s, and then at the bottom what Chelsea was like in the mid-90s when Chelsea kind of began as an art district. So by 2005, we're looking at, you know, 7-8 years of Chelsea's development, and it's become something you know, that I don't think anyone could have imagined in the mid-90s in terms of this number of galleries. At first, Chelsea was just clustered around 22nd Street, and now it runs all the way from 30th down to 14th Street in the Meat Market. I mean, it's just layers and layers of galleries on the street level up in different buildings, and it's just like a city of galleries. So that seemed complicated for a lot of the artists in our group, and thinking about alternative places to show your work and to make exhibitions. This is just feeling of what was going on. This is the Richard Gluckman designed Paula Cooper space on 21st Street. She's showing Tony Smith's Moondog here from 64. But these incredible vaulting ceiling spaces, this monumental architecture, monumental works, the cement floors, all this kind of architectural detail, the luxury, increasing luxury of the spaces, which were different from Soho spaces, which had been based on a kind of light industry and loft kind of architecture and so forth. So, and these spaces in Chelsea were, the dealers owned them, they were engaging architects, a whole new thing was happening within architecture and gallery design. Louise Lawler, an image from a 97 exhibition of hers in which she takes photographs of her gallery Metro Pictures under renovation and then hangs those photographs. So everybody's very conscious.
I didn't know she did that.
Everybody's very conscious of space, the renovation of space, the real value, you know, real estate, the expense of operating in Chelsea. All the dealers would tell their artists, you know, I have this incredible overhead now, this rent to pay. So, you know, this sense of the pressure and the activity of all that that entailed. Another work from one of our members that was really important to us, a work that really tried to critique this market boom and this gallery system, is Untitled 2003 by Andrea Fraser. This is a work that involved a commission with a private collector for a sexual encounter that was a private performance on videotape. The collector made the work with her. He agreed to be filmed for this encounter, and then the tape is shown on a monitor without sound. This is at Fraser's gallery, Friedrich Petzl in Chelsea, and here's a still of the video that was filmed in a hotel room. That kind of risk-taking, that was a really important work for us in terms of really kind of turning towards the boom and the art market, starting to deal with the figure of the private collector and kind of think about what the role of the collector was in the art world and just the incredible risk involved in doing this kind of piece. And also for Fraser, moving away from the discourse-based pieces that May I Help You, the 91 piece we worked with, represented, using her body and moving into another kind of performance as a response to that moment, I think was important. Okay, so here's just a few more examples of works from art history that really fascinated us. This is a work by Adrian Piper called Aspects of the Liberal Dilemma from 1978. It involves a sound piece that's heard on a Walkman. That was the technology from the late 70s, and she meant to refer to the kind of audio guides that museums were starting to use and the way, you know, the technology that supported them at that time in the late 70s. And there is a photograph of kind of a National Geographic type photograph of South Americans in South Africa, of men descending the staircase of a subway. So this, she was very much interested in the encounter within the aesthetic viewing experience of catalytic political and racial encounters. I mean, how to get the art viewer to deal with the question of race, how to address the art situation as a place for that kind of thinking to go on and that kind of reflection. So in the monologue that you hear, written like in an audio guide rhetoric, it starts out like, isn't this piece beautiful? And this formal description of the photograph, and then why are all the men in this photograph black? How does that make you feel? And kind of takes you through this really intense ride of what it means to kind of stand before that image and try to make sense of it. So that was a work that we borrowed for a show that was all sound works. And this is a work that, you know, many people had read about and thought about and hadn't had the experience to listen to and view firsthand. Okay, so this is a work by Rebecca Quaitman. Shows under R.H. Quaitman. It's a photograph that one of our artists, Christian Philip Muller, took of Andrea Fraser performing in front of another work that was in that opening group show, a photograph of Louise Lawler. In that photograph of Lawler's is a work by Warhol and a work by Tony
Smith. Actually, it isn't Tony Smith.
It's not Tony Smith.
No.
We don't know what the black work is.
I'm not sure what it is.
Anyway, so this just kind of layers upon layers of kind of artists working with other artists' work.
And I bought that from the show. I bought the Louise Lawler, which is another kind of complicated aspect of the gallery too, because artists were buying other artists in certain situations, and so anyway, it's like an infinite box of mirrors in a sense, that picture.
Yeah, in the sense of how artists look at each other's work. I mean, kind of staged by this photograph, seeing Fraser in the back of her head and the whole relationship of the viewer. And yet this thing that I'm trying to talk about, which is kind of what happens, our dialogues between artists over time and through art history and viewing art objects and artworks that way, what artists value, and then even ownership becomes a part of that value. Art that you're interested in, why do you look at it? Why do you think about it? And then why would we show it? And kind of that being another set of criteria and another set of values to kind of bring to the situation. And then also collaborating. So we're going to show you this work of Fraser's performance, which is a collaborative work. You know, this is a collaborative work, so artists showing each other and thinking about each other and then also making works together in the space. And then us as a group collaborating. And we can get into some of the details of what group work entailed. Just one more kind of work from the 60s and 70s that was important. This is a one-night screening that we did with Michael Asher. He had made a film in 1973. He had an idea for a film that was a cameraless film, and it involved a kind of mirroring of the means of production in film and the viewing situation of film. And it was a film that he exposed without a camera, trying to get a certain color of gray. It was shown in a very tiny space in Cambridge, Massachusetts in 1973. And we approached Asher. We were interested in this film. Another member, especially Karen Schneider, who had done a lot of work on archival work on historical experimental film. And, you know, we asked Asher if we could produce the work again. And that was this project. And the way the film works is that you can only screen it once you've printed it, because it can't have any scratches or any pictorial incident.
Right.
It's supposed to be a kind of pure...
And there were all kinds of funny stories about the film, Jeff going to get the film made at the printers and trying to explain that there was no image and it had to be this gray, and they thought he was completely insane. But it eventually got done.
And then doing it with the means and technology that obviously had changed from 1973 to 2005, which this was. And then, you know, thinking about what the reception of this piece is, we figured out that maybe four or five people saw it in 1973. So we gathered a group of people. I don't know what we had, 60 or 70. I mean, for an art historian, that's really interesting to me. You know, there's works that you read about and you research and you have this archival relationship to them, and then many things that you can't see. And then what does it mean to actually try to create a situation where you can view that work, even just once? And I had a very dear colleague of mine, Eric de Bruin, who you can see, who's Dutch, who's kind of scholar of film, and he came came to this viewing, and it was really important to us, you know, for him to view the film, and then he wrote about the film. That's the screening. Asher was really interested in what happened in this film when there was no image, and how it made the viewer very self-conscious about the space and the screening situation and the group, and so everything else kind of became the image of the film. Mm-hmm. The whole situation of the film became the image of the film. But of course you see things in the projected light as well. And there's the projector set up. In the back of our space, which has plywood in the back. And I mean, I can't really say that we offered Asher a kind of better exhibition situation than the first one he had in 1973, which was a dorm room at a high school, the Cambridge School of Western in Cambridge. And this was, you know, look at our sink, and there's a little toilet behind the sink. So this is not, we were accused a little bit with this work of sort of fetishizing history and bringing back a work from the past. But, you know, this is not a Museum of Modern Art quality, you know, kind of screening situation. So there's just a tiny, you know, piece of wallboard fit in the back there under that fan. And but Asher liked that. That's very much within his methodology, that he works with the situation as is, and we sent him photographs and have a whole exchange. So that's very much part of his work, is to that the work shows you the conditions that you're working in. And that's, the piece as we found it, known in its published form in the Asher Works and Writings book, edited by art historian Benjamin Buchla. And then this ended up being actually 2 years later, we had a public lecture where Eric DeBrun, the art historian, presented his work.
I just have to point out that the guy in the front with the little girl on his lap was the man who first showed the film in the dorm room years ago in Boston, and had since become a postman in the Catskills, but came down for this.
Yeah, we sort of found him in upstate New York, and he became a great source, along with Asher, kind of filling us in on what had happened in the first screening. Yeah. Although we never did sort out, neither one of them could really get straight. They actually disagreed about whether Michael Asher was there. Michael Asher remembered that he was there, and Paul McMahon remembered that Asher was not there for his own screening, so that's really interesting, too. Okay, so I guess we'll cue up the DVD. So this is 15 minutes, and this is Fraser in footage from Fraser over the 2 weeks in May 2005 when she's performing live. May I help you for audience at Orchard?
Pleasant things are not necessary things. That's our inheritance. freedom from the lower, coarse, vulgar, servile, material demands of the servant world. Look, it's the illusion that it hasn't been made, that none of this was paid for, nothing will be bought. It hangs there as if it just spread itself out before us voluntarily, with its own volition.
It's always been there and will always be there for us. The only work you do is wanting. I want it and I have it. It's as simple as that. And then you produce its value, an inward value, an emotional value. When you've wanted it, you've looked for it, and at last you found it. And you would do anything to have it. You want it more than your mother's love, more than money. You have to buy with your eyes, not your ears. You really buy with your soul. I always tell my clients that the criterion for buying an artwork should be whether you want to have it in your home. Loving something means having it with you. Your collection expresses the texture and quality and even the smell of your life. It signifies everything about you, from the condition of your teeth to the way that you love. You're branded by the objects you love. They mark you as the property of your culture, the property of your class. Now imagine this picture tattooed on my shoulder. It's like that. Imagine the clothes that I'm wearing and the rest of my environment have been painted on my skin, and then the whole thing is turned inside out so that it's the stuff inside. The shoes, the sofa, the dining room. You know, these are the things for which you'll be remembered. These are the things for which you'll be loved. It's always with you. It's inside. And it's outside at the same time for everyone to see. It's a prison. Oh, look at that. Certain times of day, the way the light floods in through these windows. Stunning. It's a wonderful space. I was born into a world of art. My mother was an extremely cultured and sensitive woman. All her life she was an attractive, simple worshipper of what everyone knows is the best society, the best individuals, the best standards of living with all its pertinences. When I go to a museum, like the Metropolitan, I feel right at home. That's how my mother hung her collection. But in the foyer, the dining room, the living room, the bedrooms, the guest rooms, and the halls, and the bathroom. She had one of these in the bath. It's a wonderful house. Quiet, calm, cool, like fresh linen laid in wicker trays. There's something beautiful in every corner. Flowers and the freshest smell. That's my grandmother there. She was beautiful. And that's me. You know, some people come in here and they want to invest, and then they haven't got the time. Imagine, they haven't got the time to be personally interested. On the one hand, investment. On the other, total incompetence. If you stuck a piece of shit on the wall, it'd be all the same to them as long as someone told them the shit was worth money. That's the Wall Street approach. Hedge funds. And I detest collectibles. Oh, I bought little knickknacks and trinkets that I've distributed to all and sundry. But I'd never clutter myself up. May we have some quiet in here, please? I think there was a mob of people in here pushing. I hate crowds filling the air with their breathing and their noise. For example, suburban secretaries who fill their homes with posters, prints, and Martha Stewart projects. Mother used to say it's outrageous. Making things like that ought to be banned. Horrible, horrible habits. They don't even know how to eat, those people. Heavy, thick, bloated, and fat with hunger on cheap foods. I mean, I suppose I always spoke up for everyone's right to have their own taste. I mean, why not? At least they have a taste. I mean, I think it's charming. It's so simple and fervent, so direct, so real. Sturdy, happy, uncomplicated. Leave it unspoiled and just enjoy it. That's what I always say. My mother, you know, is just an attractive, simple worshiper of what everyone knows is the best. She wasted her life on linen and flowers. It was an empty, empty, airless, dusty, meaningless life. Suffocating, sumptuous, and boring. Heirlooms? Don't make me laugh. I mean, I just can't bear the gentility of some galleries and museums. There's so much work around now, I find completely grim. I can't be bothered with it. I mean, I think it's complete tripe. And I hate people who are producing neat, tidy work. I just don't like eggs. Now, this is an artist who's doing exactly what she wants. I mean, it's a breath of fresh air. You know, I asked her once what attracted her to this subject, and she said, it just interests me. It's what I want to do. I mean, she has the capacity to surprise me on a regular basis. Sometimes she comes in here and I offer her coffee, and I get the feeling that maybe the cup isn't clean enough for her. And then the next thing I hear, she's off in Africa somewhere, rolling in the mud. Have you been to Africa? Now, this is a piece that I find wildly exciting, a tremendous wallop. What a thrill. I mean, she's the real thing. She's still out there. She's really out there. And she puts everything into her work. I mean, it's the shirt on her back. It's her neighborhood bar. It's the songs her mother sang to when she was a child. It's the man she loves. It's her life. And it's not expensive. Not expensive. It's incredible. I mean, it's a woman in a bikini at a cocktail party. It's so outrageous. Everyone thinks it's outrageous. Except me, of course. I mean, I think it's funny. And it's sexy. And it's one of the ugliest smears of paint I have ever seen. I mean, it's the top. It's a Waldorf salad. What do you think? You know, I think I must have been born with a love of the unfamiliar. It's something you can't be taught. And I'm happiest with works of my time. They reflect me. But my favorite clients have always been the ones who try to be out on the edge. You know, even if they have unlimited resources, and most of them don't. It's better to be buying artists who search out new directions, to be in the forefront with them. By the time it gets to the museums and auctions, it's safe. There's no discovery. You know, where I grew up, there was no art. I mean, there were a few family things. You know, there were pictures passed on. There was no culture. I'm the first in my family to go to college. Almost. I mean, this wouldn't mean a thing to them, except that I'm a success. That just shows you how narrow their lives are. I mean, I've always wanted art to question what I know already, to open me up as a human being so that my life is more deeply significant. Now, this is a piece that I find extremely challenging, okay? I mean, this is the kind of thing that no one without our precise history and educational background could possibly fathom. Can you believe there are still people out there asking that tired old question, is it art, right? I mean, this is about process, okay? This is about procedure. It's too easy to say, it's in a gallery. I mean, she's really an intellectual, self-possessed, reflexive. And in this piece, she's forcing the viewer to be reflexive, too. It's very risky work. It's critical. I mean, that's the kind of work she dares to do. She's never made a safe decision in her life. Doesn't know how to. That's terrific. You know, for a long time, she didn't even make anything to sell. So far away from the rational, quantitative world of business and finance. But just like in business, you have to take risks if you want an edge. Art keeps your mind limber. I always prefer risk. Creating, inventing, investing in visions of change and opportunity. You know, I was having lunch with Glenn Lauer the other day at the Modern. And Glenn said to me, he said, Andrea, there's just no place for you on our board. Go back to the Now Museum or wherever it is. I mean, imagine, that's what I want. I don't like pretentious people. I mean, people who don't know how to behave, you know, because you're not up to their level. These Ivy League graduates and cultural establishment elites flaunting their money and education, flouting our values with so-called works of art. They're taunting us, you know, they're taunting the American people. It's outrageous. Making things like this ought to be banned. I mean, this is what contemporary art has sunk to. This level, this indignity, this outrage. I mean, this is a disgrace. This isn't art. It's a perversion of art. This isn't culture. Now, this is a picture I like. It's pretty, isn't it? It's nice. It's cheerful. I stop every day once or twice, and I look at this. Somehow I feel better. Don't ask me why. I mean, I'll be tired, and I'll be sitting in a chair with my head down nearly to the floor, and I look up. I don't claim to be competent. I like art, but I don't know very many artists' names. I mean, I'd like to, but I haven't got the time. It's always the same, you know, you have to have the time. I mean, I've got a lot of trinkets and odds and ends, you know, I found in aunts and uncles' attics. They were terribly tarnished and rusty, but I cleaned them up. All those things, they're worth a bit now, they're cleaned up. In this place, no museum. But the vases aren't dust traps either. I mean, that vase now. I needed a vase for flowers. So when they asked me what I wanted, I said, a vase. And they got it, because I know how to make good use out of it. They know not to buy me things I won't use. I don't have money to throw away. I don't agree when they say get something you like. You often have to do things in life that you don't like to start with, but then you just have to like them. My mother liked to keep things clean. My mother would dust and help cook. It wasn't her job to cook. There was another woman whose job it was to cook. She would come home and describe their house. A lot of pictures, fresh linen, flowers. She passed away, my mother. Slow death in a terrible small room. I went to museums to see what it would be like to live in a big, clean, quiet house. I learned just from looking. I always wanted to be a beautiful person. I don't know. You know, maybe it's a fine piece of art, but it's not for me. I wouldn't know what to do with that. You know, this is the kind of thing that only means something to a particular type of person. Don't think that I don't understand it. I understand it. I understand that it was produced to mystify me, you know, that it was produced to exclude me. You know, if you're not one of those people who affects history, and most of us aren't, how are you supposed to enjoy looking for personal meaning in the souvenirs of that class of people who manipulate history to your exclusion? I think it takes a pretty blind state of euphoric identification to enjoy somebody's power to exclude you. I mean, when I go to galleries, I usually end up feeling angry and powerless, and I find myself thinking, who are these people, you know? I mean, where did they get their money? What does all this have to do with my experience? I don't need to come here to be told I don't belong here. I don't need to come here for culture. Culture is ordinary. Culture is common.
Hard to follow that. but that's exactly what we had to do, because that was the first show, and we had to then proceed for another 3 years following that example. So I guess I put together just a few images, and I guess I'll just sort of free associate. This is a map that was made, I think, John Kelsey made this map, but it's basically showing all the galleries 2 years ago that were opening up in the Lower East Side. So it gives you an idea of sort of the beginning of this, it was a substantial kind of movement down to the Lower East Side. And pretty much all the galleries except Deitch Projects, maybe, and I mean, most of the galleries, they all really were problematizing the gallery in some sense of the word. And most of them were pretty raw spaces, and they really were very different than Chelsea. So that's just a picture of Orchard when we first saw it. In this building, I think it was $1,200 a month at the very beginning, and we talked the landlady into putting a new floor in, and then we had a meeting one night to decide, or what are we going to do? Do we want to just leave the space raw, or do we want a white box? And in this, one of our better meetings, I'd say, as a group, we all at the end of that night decided to just make a kind of band of sheetrock, wood and sheetrock, around the entire perimeter of the gallery. But there would be no taping, right? And because we would just put the size up, and then there would be, you'd see the original gallery behind the sheetrock. That's the outside of it. During our time there, it started out as a little Buddhist temple next to us, and then it changed to a kind of high-end sneaker store while we were there. This was a show called September 11th, 1972.
Which was Chile, September 11th.
Yeah.
And Nicolas Guanini curated it, Argentinian artist, and that was very, he was very interested in that kind of resonance.
Right.
That parallelism. And so there are works by South American artists from the 70s and then recent works that artists had done in response to our 9/11.
But I think it's also important about Orchard that we weren't really a group of friends. It was a kind of odd group that just came together, basically the two of us. And, I mean, there was Nick and Karen were both South American. Gareth was British. Christian Philip Muller was Swiss. Then we have Andrea and then
Moira Davey,
Moira
Jason
Davey,
Simon.
Canadian. Not everybody knew each other, and so every show, every decision, everything from the most basic things to the biggest things were really argued amongst this group. And
everybody brought their interests and different critical agendas. We shared some interest critically, but yet it was also just a mixture.
And I think the goal of the beginning was to have as many people in the group as possible involved with every show. But by the end, pretty much everybody was doing their own show, I'd say, after 3 years. And this is a poster that Jason Simon did with Chris Marker, the filmmaker, which is a poster. It's missing a little section, but that would probably have the name of the poster on it or something. But it was Chris Marker, before he became well known for his films, was in charge of these travel books, and he did all the photography in them. And there was so Chris Marker-ish, if you know Chris Marker. So Jason, who's a maniacal collector of everything, he collected these off of eBay, and we showed them. And
worked with Marker to make this poster.
Yeah.
It was, I think, $40, right? And something that we produced and we sold in some museums and other people sold. And, you know, we had all different ideas of having art at a lot of different prices. And then also, I should say, in terms of our curatorial, historically based artistic criteria, many, many things we showed were not for sale. And then if things were for sale, we would work out agreements with the artists and we would try in our really rather amateurish and ultimately kind of pathetic way to pretend that we were art dealers and we could try to sell things.
We did, though.
But we also had this idea of really low-cost things. We always had a bookshelf with artist books. There were always different publications, and then producing these posters, we got very interested in things like that, that we could conceive mm-hmm. and realize for a small budget.
Mm-hmm.
And just different ways of trying to think about, you know, a gallery, but that there's a little bookshop area to it, and, you know, kind of other types of exchanges, mm-hmm. you know, and things to do and look at when you come into the space sort of surrounding the exhibition and related to it.
This is a Zoe Leonard installation where she just put these suitcases that she collects in the window, and it's one of my favorite pieces. We use that window space a lot. We did many different pieces in that space. And this is,
Anne Craven. Paintings by Anne Craven on the wall, and it was in,
it's called Orchids for Orchard. It was a one-night installation. We had a lot of film exhibitions, and this is one of many, and different people would come in and curate one-night exhibitions, and she just came in and hung out all those paintings of orchids that night.
And then there was film screenings that night and also films running on the monitor. Those had been programmed by Amy Granite. That mm-hmm. was really important to us at the beginning that, you know, there are exhibitions that would run for 3 or 4 weeks. We talked a lot about different time frames. But also to have a tremendous amount of programming, lectures, panels, film screenings, mm-hmm. to try to make equivalent the physical gallery space and the mounting an exhibition and like discursive space and screening. You know, this museum, we're doing what we do here in the auditorium. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the galleries with the different shows. We wanted to like almost collapse the difference between the two and make discursive activity and more ephemeral performance and filmic activity like the same, you know, as a physical object that you could come in and mm-hmm. see. So there's just, I mean, we did dozens. We got to the point at the end of the run of the gallery that almost every weekend there were two or three things. It was exhausting.
Many times a night.
And we were very flexible. I mean, artists would bring us ideas. We were very open with that part of the program. A lot of things could happen very quickly, and we just opened our doors to a lot of different people.
This is a performance that was held for 1 week by this Polish curator and a Polish artist, and they kind of were liked each other, so they said, let's do this performance where we stay in the gallery for 1 week and see if we really are in love or not. They decided at the end they weren't. And this is an exhibition I curated, I'm really proud of, by this Belgian artist called Jeff Hayes, or Gies. And it was very complicated, and I don't have the time to go into it now, but it's called Women's Questions, and it's basically a lesson that he produced for his junior high school class in a little town outside of Antwerp in the 60s. And he made it into art, his class lesson. We sold one of the big roles, and he stipulated that all the money should go not to Orchard, but to this foundation in the neighborhood that was for the neighborhood called the Henry Street Settlement. And that made a huge impression on me, actually, that he also would just give us work, original work. And, I mean, it's represented Belgium in the last Venice Biennial, so he had a very different kind of relationship with the value of the objects and money. Everything seemed to be a gift more.
Yeah, I think that was an example of, you know, we thought at the beginning that we might intervene in the market and that we might, I don't know, create some space where conceptual and political works were being sold. And I mean, at the time in that opening Bubchar, Martha Rosler didn't actually have a gallery in New York. I mean, a lot of really important artists had actually sort of gotten disenfranchised from Chelsea in terms of what was going on. Mm-hmm. And we had this idea that there would be some niche that we could fill. I mean, we really failed at that. But one thing that I think was interesting was that there's a whole realm of sort of non-monetary exchange, or that there's something beyond just the market, which is, you know, some kind of trading and some kind of other type of economy that happens like underneath or alongside, you know, that economy that everybody's looking at and taking seriously. And so a lot of these gestures and exchanges are kind of occasions to think about that. Yeah. And to do things. Also, you know, most of these shows probably had a budget under $500. Some of them had a budget like under $200. I mean, I'm not proud of the fact that we didn't manage to come up with more money just that we could, so that we could offer artists more money. I felt like we were the same as museums. Artists kind of had to pay to make their own work and bring it to us, and we didn't manage to intervene and create a better situation that way. But, I mean, we did keep everything just done, you know, as inexpensively as we could.
This is the last, or one of the last exhibitions that I did with Rhea and Amy Silman, and I put all the paintings in racks at the back, and people could pull them out and hang them on those two brackets.
And handle them, and it was really...
And Rhea did a project, will you explain your project?
In that vitrine, there were two vitrines in the front and one vitrine in the back, and I tried to work with the archive of different kinds of press and reviews and different listings and things that had been written about us. I mean, you know, I found the press embarrassing in a way, and I think it probably put me in the position of an artist. I mean, an artist having reviews on their show, and it's strange to read about yourself and think about things that you're doing and see yourself through someone else's eyes. And also our project was a group, and I mean, there were funny things, like people just couldn't stand that works were collectively made, and they got stuck trying to name us and list everybody, and they get very upset like when there isn't a single author, and so there were like wrong names all the time, and artists who weren't in a group like being given credit for shows that we did, and things like that were kind of funny. But I tried to sort of look at the whole apparatus of the press, because also there's a code, you know, when you get written about or covered. You're exciting when you're new, and so it's the hype of something new. And then there was a very funny phase when there's a lot of criticism that we're boring and we're brainy, and we were called necrophiliacs, you know, vampires because of our relationship to history. And I just tried to lay out a number of the articles so people could kind of look at the language, and I took some pull quotes out and put them at the top, and I just thought it's so interesting to see kind of how this little machine of the art press tries to kind of puts you through their system, and then what happens, you know.
And
not that it's good or bad, it's just kind of just to look at what language art criticism uses and why, you know, and kind of why it happens.
And Amy would sit in the gallery and do people's portraits, and this is, she ended up showing this in, where was it? In
this is, she ended up, in, after she showed the drawings in our show at Orchard laid out on a table, this she brought them to the Prospect One show in New Orleans, and she showed them in a group with some abstract work, and that was really interesting, like, because it was a kind of portrait of the Orchard members, but also of our audience, and it was kind of just trying to, it's an impossible and imaginary project, but the idea that you would draw everybody who had been in the space and been involved in the space, and you would kind of try to picture what this multitude was, you know, what this audience was. I mean, for a writer, I have to say that was something very interesting about the space. You know, I teach and I do art historical publications and I write some art criticism, and, you know, one really never knows who reads your work. You don't hear from the people that read your texts. And that was a very interesting exercise to just have it very concrete who our public was, to work to create that publics. There are publics within those publics. You know, one of us was always there to greet people, and we spoke to people at length, and they signed their names in the books, and we pretty much knew by sight and knew personally everyone who came into the space over that time, and that was very interesting to kind of think about. Of course, we were an audience for ourselves, but just, you know, what is the whole question of audience and art, and how does it work, and different subgroups, you know, we would show different artists, and those artists would bring their kind of audiences in, and there's a really interesting commingling of of kind of publics and subcultures and groups.
This is a very hard to see image of at the end of Orchard. I made this huge poster that's about 8 feet long of every work we showed, its title, how much it cost, if we sold it, and to who we sold it to. So it's like a full accounting, and it reads from right to left, sort of backwards. So you can see who got what commission, how much the artist made, you know, who got what discount, things like that. And it's also just a good record of the time of how much art was going for, too, and this kind of range. So,
and then there'd be film shows for weeks and weeks where nothing was for sale, so it's funny to see these gaps. And
yeah, there were a lot of gaps.
I mean, it was this idea about transparency. I don't know. I mean, this relates back to Fraser's Untitled piece, too. It's like the artists running their own gallery, questions about artists being represented by that gallery, selling their own work or selling other artists' work.
That was a hugely complicated.
This whole question of Chelsea in the market, and it's sort of like somehow artists know about when their work is sold, but it's this funny thing that the artist is always kept at arm's length from the collector, and the dealer goes in between, and it's like you just don't go there, and you can't actually talk directly about it. And I don't know, at the time it seemed really important to us to just try to open that up and look at it and just put ourselves into that situation of just trying to open that up. You know, it's also this bush, not in that time anymore, but we had a kind of crisis of authority. We were being told things about, you know, the war, untruths, this whole sense of authority in criticism, museum judgments. You know, I feel like that was really important, this transparency. I mean, it's interesting that you see that rhetoric picked up by the Obama administration and making government more transparent. There was a cultural parallel for us, and that was really what this was about. It's hard to really, there's a lot of different things that you can analyze from the time by looking at it. You know, how many artists, how you can count things, you can look at prices. You know, South American conceptual artists like Luis Kamnitzer or Uruguayan born, we had in that opening show, that text piece, This Is a Mirror, You Are a Written Sentence, incredible piece from 66 to 68. We tried to sell that. You know, I mean, something like that had no market value, and we were so fascinated with, you know, how we could think about how it was that, you know, certain artists had value in, like, conceptual art and certain artists didn't, and what we could do about that. Mm-hmm. So that becomes really different just to look at it and talk about it openly.
I think we're getting past that. We're eight. We're an hour. Should we open it up for questions, maybe?
Yeah? Absolutely, yeah. We are.
Yeah, no.
I just had a follow-up to the thing about the finances. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about, say, like, you know, how rent was paid or other kinds of expenses, and then with sales, how the commissions went to dealers or directly to artists.
Right. Well, the beginning, basically, me and my husband paid the rent in the idea that if any sales were made, a percentage of that would go to pay back the rent. In addition, each artist in the group had to pay $150 a month towards expenses.
We structured it like a 70s style cooperative, you know, like the Feminist Gallery, AIR. So we were for-profit. It was really important that we were not not-for-profit. We thought nonprofits were an obsolete model in contemporary art that ended up putting their hats out to the commercial art market, and it was like a contradiction to take that money and put it, you know. So we just, you know, and we had this, we had these formulas. I mean, we had some members who invested more, so we had a kind of credit, so we didn't not worry, you know, about like not being able to pay the rent every month. But then we had this strict formula of the dues,
the dues, the expenses, basically, and if anything sold,
being divided.
And I think we're almost, I think are covered. So, because we're still selling work, we just sold this to MoMA. So I'm really happy about that. And we sold the May I Help You film. It's an edition of 10, I think. So we sold one to MoMA. And we also, one of the things that we did in the beginning that was hugely important financially was we made this edition, this Dan Graham edition, slide piece. And that sold for...
That was one of our most high-priced works. Yeah. It was $40,000.
And that really went a long way to help cover, defray costs. But we had to work in a very complicated way with Marion Goodman and his gallery in Belgium, and all that stuff was really interesting to see and learn and experience.
Yeah, I mean, and talking about, you know, we paid the artist 50% or sometimes more, and then that was what happened is that we realized some artists didn't have galleries. We worked with them directly. We could pay them even 60 or 70%. But then the artists who did, I mean, we had to pay the gallery enormous commissions, and actually we really couldn't get them to discount them very much. So that was really kind of a surprise to us, that there'd just be 10 or 15% of the price that would ever circulate in Orchard. That, and, you know, you just start to see kind of how those...
Well, you start to see how group shows in Chelsea happen just to promote gallery artists, and that... So that was also just, I think, very important that we could do these shows that weren't just fiscally driven completely. But yeah.
Nobody else has been asked. I want you just to talk. I know we don't have a whole lot of time, but I just want you to talk a little bit about just getting along in this situation. Like, getting that many people with that many personalities and such.
Yeah, I'll answer it quickly and then you will. I mean, at the beginning, it was a really exciting, critical conversation that we kind of brought all of our critiques of the art world and all of our shared interests, and we just seemed to have so many ideas, and it was like so exciting and generative to work in this group. But we had a lot of highly opinionated people, so there was a lot of arguing. I mean, we had a lot of confident, very verbal people, so also people enjoyed arguing vigorously, and it was, you know, it was fine. And then it just, you know, slowly it just wasn't fine, and people did get hurt, and there were arguments that just took a long time to resolve. I mean, I think in that sense, we weren't really good at doing collective work. We were a bunch of 12 authors who had 12 opinions, and... Mm-hmm. you know, there was a lot of incredible and collective work done in the 80s and 90s, you know, a group like ACT UP or something. These are activists. They really know how to do group process. They have a whole process. They have minutes. They have present things. And we never were good about our group process. I mean, we should have brought, like, a group therapy person in or somebody to help us.
Seriously.
Just get some basic procedures down so we could go through a meeting and go through our agenda and, you know, not end up in endless hours of argument. And, you know, we weren't good at that part of it.
We didn't realize at the beginning, for example, that email is a real place of flair, you know, that you really can't even have the discussions on email. Because it would just escalate into just fire in an instant when
people
the person's
things,
writing it on email.
Yeah, they'll say things that they wouldn't say to your face when you're in physical. We had physical meetings, you know,
that were
frequently
better.
And then we would follow up and do things as everyone does over email, and things would really get complicated.
So things like that. And then we had to decide everything by consensus. That was the other decision we made, not by majority, and that was tiring, exhausting.
Well, I really appreciate this. I think it's been so enlightening, and I just want to know, as we go, was it worth it?
I definitely feel that it was the fights that were in the end the great thing about it. It wasn't that we all agreed and we're all buddies. It was that these arguments really generated something, I think, important. And it was great for us.
I think at a time the waning of theory, I mean, you know, in the 70s they already talked about pluralism. I mean, how can you describe what we're in right now as pluralism? I mean, we're in, I don't know, and it's not a theoretically or politically focused moment. So I think just that sense of coming together with a group of like-minded people and clarifying, you know, a sense of critical issues and historical issues. I mean, for me, it was very generative for my work. We took that back to our individual work. None of our individual work stopped during the time. We all taught, had day jobs. Rebecca was the only one who had a sort of job at Orchard as our director, unpaid, and we had interns, but we all were doing all the stuff we had to do to make money, and Orchard was like our hobby, our thing on the side. But I really drew from it, you know, kind of just the whole sense of feeling that I had a group of peers and that we, you know, we were really working from something. Reading each other's texts, responding to things that we were making. In that sense, we were almost like an editorial group for each other. We had a lot of ideas about criticism and writing, not many of which came to pass because it turned out to be so much energy just to do the space. And I'm actually glad we focused on the space and not on written discourse as much as I'm committed to criticism, because I think we are at such a confused theoretical and political moment that the talking that we did in the shows, it's like finding what the critical problems were. It just was much more flexible space, and it was just conversations that were changing and ongoing, and it was like
that,
you know,
does remind
a space.
Me though, there is money for you to do a book. Because every time every time we made a sale, we'd put 10% towards a
this
book.
Publication to come or publication.
And it's still sitting there.
Do. It's sitting there in the account.
Yeah. That's my instinct.
Yeah.
I hope you do that book.
Well,
have you back?
Well, we can take this back to the group of 12. Like how you can edit and author a group with 12 people.
Good luck.
All right, thank you so much.
Thank you.